Broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Tuesday morning. A quick programming note, we will not be here on Thursday, as I think during this particular point in time, I'll be driving from Philadelphia to somewhere in, driving to Toms River. I guess that's sort of in the middle of New Jersey someplace. So no Dividing Line on Thursday, but we, Lord willing, will be back again next Tuesday at our regular time here on The Dividing Line. Just a couple thoughts about various sundry things. First of all, my apologies. I have not yet gotten up the response that I want to post on Jimmy Akin's comments on James chapter 2 and the syntax of the Greek article there in James chapter 2. I was, quite honestly, a little bit surprised by what I read on the blog there, but I guess I shouldn't be, but we will be responding to that as soon as we possibly can, hopefully by this afternoon. But when you've got a short week and you got to get packed and everything else, things just sort of pile up on each other. I do need somebody in channel should give me the weather forecast for, say, Friday. Highs and lows in Toms River, because something tells me I'm going to catch back up with this front that came up through here, and I should probably bring some warm clothes. I have a feeling. I don't know. We'll find out. Don't want to forget about the fact that it was pretty cold here. It got cold here. We had pipes bursting here in Phoenix, and that's pretty unusual for us. No two ways about it. That doesn't happen. In fact, I don't think we'd had a hard freeze in at least 5 or 6 years.
Since 1990.
A hard freeze?
Since that long, yeah.
You're kidding. Yeah. I knew it had been a few
years. See, the thing is the people back east don't understand how you have pipes bursting. Being in the desert, we don't wrap our pipes. We bury our water lines 2 feet down in the ground as they come out from the street, and then we run them through our attic.
Yeah.
And they're not wrapped or anything like that. And so, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, no reason to do anything like that. It was Sunday morning was the coldest morning in 17 years in Phoenix. And so, hey, what can I say? Let's see. Friday, highs around 40, chance of precipitation 30%. That's 40s. That's nothing. It got up to, 48 or something. Hey, I'm wasting time. Wanted to make some comments on the program about last Thursday and the result of last Thursday. As you may recall, I took about a half an hour and I played a few clips from the Stop and Think video. And, could be a tempest in a teapot type situation. There's only a certain number of blogs and websites of people who would even openly proclaim themselves to be Reformed who comment on things. And there was quite a lot of disagreement. I felt a lot of disagreement that was based primarily upon assuming what you thought somebody else was saying and then responding to what you assumed they were saying. I mean, there are folks within what calls itself the broader Reformed community that just detest yours truly. There's no two ways about it. And so it doesn't matter what I say. It's going to be taken, they're going to hear it in whatever way they want to hear it. And twist it whatever they want to twist it, and that's just sort of the way things are, and I'm accustomed to that, and it doesn't bother me nearly as much as it used to. That's for certain. I posted a few blog articles. I discussed a few things in relationship to especially the fact that it seems, it's one thing. We can all sit around and go, yeah, Dave Hunt's What Love Is This? Boy, that's pretty bad stuff. But it almost seems like the omnibenevolence viewpoint that he has of an undifferentiated love of God that can in no way, shape, or form have any distinctions to it gets lost on even folks who call themselves Reformed when it comes to certain areas like the proclamation of the gospel. Now, I don't know how many times I've said this. Maybe, I bet you Algo knows. We'll ask Algo in channel because Algo knows all things, and Algo knows everything I've ever said, when I said it, and what tone of voice I used when I said it. That's why he frightens me. But Algo probably can count up for us how many times I have said, we do not know the identity of the elect. How many times in responding to the canners and responding to various people speaking down at Johnny Hunt's church where he turned the pulpit into an anti-Calvinism seminar location, how many times have I said the problem with so much of this argumentation is we don't, it assumes that we Calvinists claim to know who the elect are. We don't. We don't know. And so that explains why we have all that experience in Salt Lake City and Mesa and standing along the, what was that, a creek? Was that Cherry Creek? Was that where you're down? Was that actually the creek we were in? Or was that sort of, I forget.
I think that was right alongside the creek.
Yeah, it was weird. It was down.
Sure, yeah, it was down in, but there was another area. So there's like a walkway right along
the creek.
Right along the edge of the creek.
Yeah, but you almost had to climb down into it. It was really weird. Remember that?
That's everybody's walking through, you know.
On their way to Mass.
Yes. On the way, well, to Cherry Creek Park.
Where there's the Papal Mass.
Yes.
That's where they were going. So anyways, that was where Rich and I were passing out tracts to the Roman Catholic there.
We had pictures. And we were looking for those people.
Yeah, well, that's right. Here's the elect. Like, and we're like, okay, that one, nope.
Not him. Don't give him the track. Don't give him the track. No, not him. No.
But yeah, isn't it good that we have gone so much farther now than we could in 93? Because now we have that special elect metal detector.
That's right.
And they just walk through that, and if they're elect, it beeps, and if they're not, it doesn't. And that works so much better now.
But then there are those who exercise free will and don't want to walk through the metal detector. And
well, but that proves right then and there that they're not the elect. The elect will walk through the metal detector. So
yes, we've got it all figured out.
We just don't know. So we passed out tracts to everybody. And people... It's a matter of balance. It's a matter of balance. It really, 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 really is a matter of maintaining some balance here. Obviously, what seems to have been missed by a lot of folks, and I think we need to think about this. We've got a problem in our nation. Look around, especially at the churches, at the churches in general. Don't limit it too much, but look around at churches that at least try to take the Bible seriously. Brother Tom Askell has rather openly stated that he views the Southern Baptist Convention as an unregenerate denomination, that our churches are filled with unregenerate people. And I think that's a very, as you said at our conference, we've lost the gospel, and I think that's a completely valid observation to make. I mean, in how many churches can you seriously preach the whole counsel of God and not get yourself booted out? That tells you something. That tells you something about the nature of the people that are in there. They are the religiously hypocritical. They are those who continue to bow the knee to self and have had a Christian layer of icing put on top of them, but that doesn't change the inside. And how do you get churches filled with unregenerate people? Well, you got to get them in there somehow. And so you use these methodologies, you use these ways of getting them in there. But if you don't challenge their sinful rebellion, you end up with a church filled with sinful rebels who now think, and now they're even worse because now they think they're right with God because you have given them this promise that if they would walk down a certain aisle, shake a hand, do a certain thing, fill out a card, whatever, boom, they've got their ticket punched on the way to heaven. I've really been thinking, I think that the utter heresy, and I don't pull any punches anymore, especially after my experience with Bob Wilkin in 2005, it's simple heresy. The heresy of the cheap gracers who actually believe that God has no purpose in salvation, none whatsoever. He's just there as the celestial ticket puncher, and he punches your ticket. and you're going to heaven, and now he could care less about the rest of your life. He doesn't, he has no purpose in conforming you to the image of Christ, nothing like that at all. I think that heresy has had a significantly wider impact than most people think that it has. Because there is this idea that, well, hey, as long as it works, isn't it better that it works? Well, is it working? If it is your methodology working if it fills your church with unregenerate people? Now, again, there's a balance here because everybody can go look back in time and you can look back to, let's look back to Spurgeon's day. Let's look back to England. I mentioned this on the Dividing Line before. I was there in, I think, February of last year, and I was speaking in London, and so many of the questions came about hyper-Calvinism, about hyper-Calvinistic churches, and people whose experience was coming out of these hyper-Calvinistic churches. They could have no assurance of their salvation, all the rest of this stuff. And I was a little bit taken aback by that because that's just not our experience here. But it certainly was over there, and it certainly was in the past. And you can have people who become so, again, imbalanced the other direction that you somehow have to demonstrate an absolute perfection of salvation. You have to be able to quote the entirety of 14 catechisms before you can ever get through the door of the church. And so you end up with nothing. Well, that isn't our problem here. Okay? And I think one of the things that got lost here is that societies change, contexts change. Everybody's talking about, well, that video is a wonderful contextualization of the gospel message, you know, and the surfing and the California thing and so on and so forth. Okay, let's really contextualize for a moment. What is the greater danger in Western society today? Filling churches with unregenerate people because you have presented a God who's basically your buddy? Or the dangers of the hyper-Calvinism that we were just talking about. I mean, think about our society for a moment. Think about what has changed. All the biblical paradigms of royalty, of lordship. We live in the United States, and everybody's equal, see? I've got my rights, and God better keep in mind the Bill of Rights around here. I mean, the idea of me being clay and he's the potter. Oh, no. Egalitarianism all the way, not just men and women, but God gets in on this too. And we may allow him to run around and play with stars and stuff. We really don't believe he does that because there's natural processes and we're good naturalists and materialists. When you really start getting down to push and shove, we've imbibed so much of the society there. We're good naturalists and materialists. God's just sort of overseeing these natural processes. He got him started. He clicked his fingers, did the Big Bang, and now he's just sort of, you know, doing his thing. He's not really overly involved with stuff. But we'll let him do the things out there. But when it comes to man, oh, no. We don't want a creator like that. We don't want a creator who's actively involved in human experience. Can't have that. So we want a God. And this is the main part that just of the video that just made me want to hide under a chair someplace. We want a God who's actually able to get down on one knee and beg us for a relationship. Beg us for a relationship. He's desperate, man. Please accept me. I mean, we've got folks running around right now. They're doing Google searches and PDF searches and everything else for the word beg. Just try to find someplace where, see, it's okay to be a Calvinist and say God begs you for a relationship. The problem is, all those citations, this one particular person I'm thinking of has found, aren't in the modern context. They're in a context where people still understood the idea of royalty and power and sovereignty. And we're not in that context. We're in a humanistic context. We're in a context where people think that they can make God our size. And that God has to, well, in essence, respect my rights. We live in a humanistic post-Christian society, folks. And when you put God on one knee begging for you to marry him, not even the right paradigm there, that's the church anyways, proposals and marrying and all the rest of that stuff, that's a church. We've got this individualistic Western society focused upon man, and you put God down his knee, and I'm sorry, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. And I can't imagine that there is anyone who would object to this. from a, who claims to be Reformed in any way, shape, or form. We've got to remember the cultural context in which we're dealing with these things, because that's not the cultural context that existed even 150 years before. People understood who lords were. They understood where their position in society was. We don't have that anymore. And so all those elements of the biblical, those are gone. And so that's why we have to emphasize these things. That's why we have to be careful about these things, or we're going to end up presenting a God who's just really overjoyed to have you on his team. And that ends up explaining what so many of our churches end up looking like today. You know, when, where, how do you put together the fact that, that you say to people, well, what do you say then to people? What do you say in your witnessing? Cry to God for mercy. Cry to God for mercy. If you don't think that would be something Spurgeon would have said, you haven't read much Spurgeon. Cry to God for mercy. That's not the same thing as stop and think and, you know, God's on his knees in front of you going, please have a relationship with me. Look at all I've done for you. Have coming. Come on, man. Be nice. Look at all that God's done for you. Be nice to God. That's not the same thing as cry to God for mercy, because to cry to God for mercy means you're at the end of your rope. You don't have anything left. You have been emptied of everything. You see your absolute guilt before God. You've been broken, and you cry to God for mercy. I don't see that as the same thing as add God to your vitamins so you can have a better life. Now, one more comment along those lines. Don't make a massive mistake here. Everybody jumps the idea.
Oh, you're attacking Pastor Chan.
No, I'm not. It could have been an actor in that thing. I don't care. I'm talking about one presentation.
You're saying, well, you're taking out of context of everything else he's done in his ministry.
I'm not the one that spent I don't know how much money, which no one's even mentioned that, putting together this video. Okay? The problem we have today is that we can't disagree with a position or a statement without people automatically thinking that we're trying to be mean to a person. This is the same thing I've complained about over and over again with people like Dave Hunt. With historical individuals, early church fathers, they'll find something they don't like, something they consider heretical, and for someone like Dave Hunt, it could be, you know, not being a dispensational premillennialist, which would pretty much make everybody up until the 1800s a raving heretic if you want to make him that. And you can go after him on that basis, and therefore you can just dismiss everything that they ever said. That is irrational, and that's not what I'm doing. I would like to think that the illustrations that I've talked about, the examples I've talked about in the video, are just simply an aberration, that they're not a consistency. But at the same time, let's face it, if they are an aberration in this context, they're not an aberration in the broader evangelical context of the United States today. This is what a lot of people are getting the idea that what Christians are saying is, man, God is so desperate to have a relationship with you that he's on one knee begging you. Instead of God commands men everywhere to repent, cry out for mercy. You know, and I see a contradiction between that kind of a statement and the earlier statement in the video about God's wrath and judgment and his law and stuff like that, you know. And even though the law had already been sort of, I don't know, turned into the suggestions, hey, you know, if you don't kill each other, you'll have a better life. No, you don't kill each other because God said not to. He's your creator. Life is sacred. It's you know, I don't see those two as quite fitting real well, but be it as it may, at least something was said about God's wrath and God's holiness earlier on, but it doesn't seem to fit real well with the later presentation. So I just wish we could have, you know, discussions about this without all the personality stuff and this person said this and this person said that. And I think the most disappointing thing has just been how there's been almost no meaningful conversation. It's all been knee-jerk reactions and taking sides and lobbing bombs this way and that way. And I've mentioned this in channel. I think, honestly, that there should be about one one-hundredth the number of blogs that allow for comments as there are. I am officially launching the anti-blog comments movement. Now, everybody knows I don't have any. And I cannot even begin to imagine what my comment section would look like on a regular basis. Can you imagine the Muslims and the Mormons and the King James Onlyists and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Oneness Pentecostals and the atheists, along with the radical Arminians, who would all be jumping on no matter what was said? Can you imagine? Let's face it. If you want to say something on the internet, there is nobody who can't go out and get himself a blog, right? I mean, how long does it take to set up a blog? You go to blogspot.com and what? You know, 5 minutes most if you're a slow typist. And so if you want to go and tell the whole world what you think, then get your own blog. No one's stopping you. The fact of the matter is what you end up having in comments is a bunch of folks who have blogs, but nobody reads them. And so they go to the blogs of people that actually want, you go, you know, I'd like to know what that person has to say. And so you create your blog role and whatever, and you go on these blogs, and it's people trolling for more blog traffic to their own, in essence, in many instances. But it really becomes the place where you just simply concentrate the ignorance of the internet in theological subjects. And there is a massive amount of ignorance in the internet on theological subjects. Let me tell you that. And then throw in the problem of anonymity. No one can see you. You can hide behind your keyboard. And it's like, you know, leaving open containers of gasoline around. Guess what's going to happen over time? Boom. You know, like end of the last episode of 24. Boom. Boom, 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 boom. Very big boom. So I really think that, especially in the theological realm, there should probably be something along the lines of, you know, either limiting who can comment to people who have demonstrated a capacity to do so over time, or you know, from my perspective, my RSS reader doesn't even show comments. I mean, if I want to know what somebody says, my RSS reader tells me. I don't care about the comments. I'm sorry. If I wanted to know what those folks said, I'd go read what they had to say. But there's only so much time in a day to do what you need to do. And how many decent discussions have been sidetracked by the comments section? They've just been blown up, torpedoed. So I'm starting the end of comments movement. And obviously, I am the president of the movement because I've never had them. What?
Boycott them.
Boycott them? I don't.
No, we're boycotting comments.
Oh, well, we've always boycotted comments.
See, there you go. Starting the end of comments boycott.
Yeah, but we've always done that. Now I'm just inviting everybody else to join. I mean, the Calvinist gadfly did it, but that's because he doesn't have enough time to keep up with it. But now I want it to become a conviction on his part because he's listening right now anyway. So anyways, there's just some of the thoughts that I've got on that stuff, because it's been amazing to me over the weekend.
I did have one comment about the idea.
Are you a commenter on my audio blog?
Yeah, as you, right now, at the moment, yes, I am.
Do you feel any inconsistency here?
No, I don't.
Oh, is that because you have control of all the knobs and control?
I control the vertical and the horizontal at this moment. Yes. But the idea, the mental picture of Christ bowing or bending his knee to beg us, and you talk about crying for mercy, and it just flies utterly opposite of what the gospel really is, in the fact that it is to be, as Philippians 2:10 tells us, every knee shall bow before him. Yeah. It is our knee that is to be bowing before him, begging him for mercy. He doesn't beg us. We are to be begging him.
Oh, but
him.
There have been a few. There's two or three citations you can find where someone has used the word beg. Now, of course, it's a completely different context. But, yeah, I am fully in agreement, and that was my whole point.
Every knee will bow and every tongue confess Christ the Lord.
I know. Well, that comes later. See, once you get them in with the nice picture of Jesus bowing before them, then maybe you can teach them over time, and then maybe someday they'll bow the knee in reverse. Now, of course, what that means is what you're teaching them is what you got them in with was a lie. And I guess some folks don't have any problem with that at all. As long as it works, as long as we are pragmatic, then that's okay. Now, a lot of you are going, oh, you're being mean to somebody. No, I don't actually, in all my comments just now, I was only thinking about one person when I was thinking about anybody at all. Most of the time, I didn't have any particular individual in mind. If you're sitting here going, well, I think that one was written to that person, and now he's got that and that, nah, get off that stuff. Just listen to what I'm saying in general and forget the politics of it. I'm not a politician. If I was in politics, I'd be the world's worst politician. No two ways about it. I don't do the alliances thing. I don't do the, like I said in my blog, and I mean this seriously. And this makes me very unpopular with a lot of people. Believe me, I know. You'll never see me up there with the big guys because I've ruined any chances of ever doing that because I refuse to take this filter and put it between me and this microphone in front of me or me and my fingers on the blog. And sit here and go, okay, if I'm going to say this, all right, now I've got to think about what this group's going to say and this group and this minister over here and that individual and that author and this preacher. And I've got to run through all these things. And by the time you run the truth through all those filters, there's not much left of it. And to be honest with you, I'm just not smart enough. I'm just not smart enough to do that kind of stuff. I'm just not. Sorry. Don't have the capacity. Just don't have it. So there you go. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. And I'm afraid we have some calls, but I know that the one's going to take quite some time to cover, and I doubt you're going to be able to do the break for another a minute and a half or so. And pray right there. Okay. All right. So I'm gonna take the second call first. See if we can squeeze it in here. Let's talk to Medford. Hi, Medford.
Hi.
Hi. What's up?
Hi. How are you?
Doing good.
Am I on the radio? This is Dr. White, right?
Uh huh.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize. I just have a question. I had my first real experience with some Jehovah's Witnesses lately, recently, and I talked to them. And afterwards, I felt like, you know, it went really, really well, except for the man yelled at me. But his wife stayed and talked for about 5 minutes, which was very nice. But anyway, afterwards, I was looking through your website, and I didn't see that you had any thing that specifically addressed Jehovah's Witnesses. Am I overlooking a book? I have your King James only. I have your,
Well, there's an entire section called Jehovah's Witnesses on the website.
I've read all the articles. I mean a book specifically.
No, there's no reason for me to write a book on Jehovah's Witnesses because I don't write books that someone else has already written.
Okay.
Anything that I have relevant to say to that, I have either said on the blog in the debate with Greg Stafford or in The Forgotten Trinity. There are excellent works on the subject of Jehovah's Witnesses already out by folks like Dwayne Mignani. So there's no reason for me to be writing books that people have already written. The Watchtower Files is real good.
What do you think of John Ankerberg's book?
I don't have it. I try to read specialists in the field, and so I'm forgetting the name off the top of my head right now of the other individual. We have carried his books in the past on the witnesses. I'd have to look. But Dwayne Mignani, and then there's somebody else that the name is escaping me at the moment. But there are like I said, works by specialists that are the best. And I don't.
Okay, so Mignani would be the one to look up.
Yeah, and there's another one, I just right now can't think of the name.
Okay, all right. Can I ask you one other thing?
Real quickly, yeah.
Just very quickly. I've noticed recently on flipping through the channel a lady named Melissa Scott, and she does a lot of various languages on I don't know if you know who I'm talking about.
Nope, never heard of her.
Okay, all right. Well, then I won't take up any more
of your time. Okay, no. What kind of a channel are you flipping through?
Well, she's on a religious station, And I don't know if you've ever just been flipping through. Next time you're flipping through the channels, just watch for a lady who is going into not only the Greek but the Syriac, every language you can imagine. She seems to be a pretty good as far as languages go, but her theology is not.
That explains why she's going into Syriac. The only reason that anyone would ever need to go into Syriac in teaching is to refute a specific assertion made. For example, I was reading Craig Evans' book on Jesus last night, and not reformulating Jesus, but not reconstructing Jesus either. I can't remember anything today. Anyway, I was reading his book, and he was responding specifically to a couple of extra biblical gospels and the claims by people like John Dominic Crossan that those are very, very early. And so as a result, he had to deal with Coptic Syriac, especially in regards to the Gospel of Thomas and where it possibly came from and linguistic stuff. That's the only reason you would ever need to get into anything like that. The only other reason someone would do that is that they have a heresy that they're trying to promote. They can't do it out of the Greek and the Hebrew, so they have to come up with something else as if it's somehow relevant. And that way you prey upon ignorant people who are looking for a reason to disbelieve.
Okay.
And that really is how it works.
Her name is Pastor Melissa Scott.
Well, there's the problem right there.
Well, I know that. That was not even...
It's Gene Scott's widow.
Yes, it is.
It's just a carbon copy of Gene Scott.
Oh, there you go. And I have a hard time. She's probably just repeating the lunacy that he put out. So
she is. She is. And I didn't know if you knew any more about her, but obviously you know a little bit enough to know that that's probably what she's saying isn't really...
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. All righty. Okay, thank you, sir.
We'll see you in October.
Okay, bye-bye.
God bless.
Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. We'll be back after our break right here on The Dividing Line.
The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture texts on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomin.org. Public Crimes. The Criminal Mishandling of God's Word may be James White's most provocative book yet. White sets out to examine numerous crimes being committed in pulpits throughout our land every week, as he seeks to leave no stone unturned. Based firmly upon the bedrock of Scripture, one crime after another is laid bare for all to see. The pulpit is to be a place where God speaks from His Word. What has happened to this sacred duty in our day? The charges are as follows. Prostitution using the gospel for financial gain. Pandering to pluralism. Cowardice under fire. Felonious eisegesis. Entertainment without a license. And cross-dressing, ignoring God's ordinance regarding the roles of men and women. Is a pulpit crime occurring in your town? Get Pulpit Crimes in the bookstore at aomin.org. This portion of The Dividing Line has been made possible by the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. The Apostle Paul spoke of the importance of solemnly testifying of the gospel of the grace of God. The proclamation of God's truth is the most important element of His worship in His church. The elders and people of the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church invite you to worship with them this coming Lord's Day. The morning Bible study begins at 9:30 a.m. and the worship service is at 10:45. Evening services are at 6:30 p.m. on Sunday, and the Wednesday night prayer meeting is at 7. The Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church is located at 3805 North 12th Street in Phoenix. You can call for further information at 602-26-GRACE. If you're unable to attend, you can still participate with your computer and real audio at prbc.org, where the ministry extends around the world through the archives of sermons and Bible study lessons available 24 hours a day.
And welcome back to The Dividing Line. Two things. David Reed is the name I was not able to think of there. His writings on the Watchtower Society, very good. I recommend those. And then, Pastor Melissa Scott. Looks like his granddaughter, actually, to be very honest with you. She looks like she's about 40 years younger than him. But and she's got her little backwards collar thing going, and okay, well, like I said, there's a lot of stuff running around.
Yes, but does she have funny glasses and a big cigar? That's the question.
I don't see the cigar thing going on here. That's which is good. It's best that they're not.
Oh, Gene smoked them until there was no tomorrow. I used to run by there on my satellite, and every now and then just kind of sit and watch and go, oh, my. You know, three guys standing there wearing two or three pairs of glasses, one on top of the other, and he always wears some funny-looking hat.
Okay, all
smoke
right.
Cigars and preach.
There you go. Nothing like drawing attention to yourself. Anyways, let's get back to the phone calls here, and let's talk with Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dr. White.
How you doing?
Good. Hey, a question for you on John chapter 6 and John 12. What do you do with Arminians, you know, like ultra-dispensationalists like Lawrence Vance, who basically disqualify, you know, the drawing in John 6 due to John 12:32, or they make it a universal thing starting after the cross?
Well, that particular argument is probably the most common idea. Now, the use of John 12 is extremely common, limiting it to some dispensational concept. Is a little bit more unusual, but there are a number of people who do that in regards to trying to say, well, all that we're talking about in John 6 has to do with Jews, doesn't have to do anything with Gentiles, doesn't have to do with you today, et cetera, et cetera. And it's another wonderful example of the eisegetical leaps to which people will go for a number of reasons. First of all, to even go to John 12 to interpret John 6 is to mean that what Jesus was saying in John 6 could not have been understandable to anybody that he was talking to at the time. To say further that John 6 is no longer relevant now would also mean that John 3 is no longer relevant now. And in fact, basically, to go that direction, to be consistent, you'd sort of have to go with the hyper-dispies who end up with just Paul's writings, because you can't tell what in the Gospels is actually relevant once the church age gets going. The church has rightfully, well, first of all, that whole concept did not develop until very, 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 very late. And if 1,800 years of church history passed on anybody coming up with that, that's probably a fairly decent indication that that is not what the original writers could have even begun to understand or intend in their writings. But beyond that, beyond just taking wild, overarching concepts and saying, well, you know, if it's in the Gospels, it's not about the church, and therefore we're not going to worry about it. To the more sober-minded person, you recognize that what Jesus is addressing in John 6 is the unbelief of these individuals right in front of him. And he is in the synagogue Capernaum, and so, yes, these would be Jewish individuals. There's no question about that. But what he says is consistent with what Paul says about salvation itself. And so when you give that consideration and allow the text to speak for itself, what is said in John chapter 6 about eternal life, about unbelief, the reasons for unbelief, that's not just the reasons for Jewish unbelief. There's nowhere does it say you are the children of Abraham and therefore you have done X, Y, or Z. Instead, Jesus speaks in very generic terms. When he talks about the unbelief of those who have heard his preaching, who are standing right in front of him, and explains why they have unbelief is because they have not been given by the Father to the Son, and that he will never cast out those that the Father has given to him, and so on and so forth. These become foundational, Christological and soteriological assertions that it is sad to see Arminians attempt to get rid of these things just simply because it doesn't fit within their concept of free will. Maybe there's some of that. I've wanted to recently make some comments about the book Why I'm Not a Calvinist by Jerry Walls and Joseph Dongle.
Right, and this particular guy is getting a lot from that book.
Yeah, yeah, and his comments on John 6 are their comments, I'm sorry, on John 6 are again, it amazes me when I see entire books written that pretend to address this issue, and they can handle texts like John 6 in less than one physical page, both sides. You know, when you do that, you've missed the boat, in my personal opinion. But page 74 of the Walls Dongle book. But the Calvinist reading likewise fails to account fully for the context. So they want to. It's interesting. They'll very frequently say, "Well, the context of John 6 is actually John 5." Well. Okay, I mean, you could say all of John is the context of John 6, depending on how wide you want to make your context, but the immediate context of the key text in John 6 is, but I say to you, you are not believing. You are unbelievers. These are people seeking after Jesus. He says, you're unbelievers, and the rest explains that. That almost, I can't think of almost anybody, now that I'm trying to go through the many, 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 many interpretations of John 6 that I've examined, I can't think of anybody who actually honestly deals with that. That part just gets completely lost. Instead, this is what they do here. Let me go ahead and read it. But the Calvinist reading likewise fails to account fully for the context. Jesus is locked in strenuous debate with religious leaders who claim special knowledge of and standing with God. From this privileged position, they seek to discredit Jesus completely. Their implied charge essentially involves an attempt to sever Jesus from God, affirming the latter while rejecting the former. In doing this, they wish to establish the right to claim, we know God intimately, but you are utterly alien to us. We stand in right relationship to God, but we completely reject you, end quote. Well, there's an element of truth to that. They clearly claim to be the standing in the tradition of Moses. They clearly are seen by the people as being the recipients of divine tradition, in a sense. And they're seen in that way. And Jesus has to deal with those errors all along, but that's not the only thing that's under discussion here. They are rejecting his claim to have that relationship with the Father, and he is continually recognizing and exposing the fact that they don't actually love the Father because they don't love him. Jesus' countercharge strikes directly at the root of their authority, the presumption that they knew God in the first place. You have never heard his voice, nor seen his form, nor does his word dwell in you, John 5:37-38. Far from knowing God then, Jesus' opponents had already rejected not only the testimony of John the Baptist, but also of Moses. If you believe Moses, you believe me. If he wrote about me, but since you do not believe what he wrote, how are you going to believe what I say? John 5:46. In this question posed by Jesus, we discover the key principle. Rejecting God's first offerings of truth will utterly block further illumination. Now, the problem with that is everyone who ends up following Jesus, many of them had blocked, quote-unquote, rejected God's first offerings of truth. But you can see the presupposition of libertarianism and a denial of total depravity here. But here comes the overarching theme that's going to be used to get around the specific exegesis of the text. God will not offer more truth or manifest his full glory, the eternal Son, while light at hand is being spurned. I would point out that God has revealed himself in all of creation, and yet he then reveals himself in Christ. That's sort of hard to follow. In other words, we can't actively reject the Father at the same time have any chance of accepting the Son. Well, that's a truism in and of itself. There's no question about that. Since the Father and Son are one in nature, character, and mission, the rejection of one necessarily involves the rejection of the other. The fundamental issue of this passage is not that of predestination, but of Christology and the unity of the Father and the Son. I would say the error they make here is to just distinguish between the two in the first place, in the sense that, yes, there is no question that the text in John 5 involves Christology. The text in John 6 involves Christology. 7, Christology. 8, Christology. 9, Christology. All of that is true. But since all those texts also address faith, salvation, wrath, forgiveness, and everything else, then the point is that your Christology cannot be separated from your soteriology. You can't have a false Jesus and have true faith in God. No question about that. But to say that issues like predestination, explaining unbelief, are not there because you're talking about Christology, completely unwarranted. It's in essence, a means of trying to bypass the actual text here. The Jewish opponents' inability to come to Jesus did not lie then in the hidden eternal plan of God, but in their own track record of trampling prior light, of having already denied God himself and spurned God's corrective punishment. Now, I stop right there and go, wait a minute. Professors, gentlemen, where's the exegesis? You just jumped from John 5. You made some semi-true statements about some overarching concepts. And now you've jumped into sex, and you've made a concluding statement about what the text is and is not saying. But the text itself has never even been touched. It hasn't even been exegeted. You haven't even tried to follow the flow of the text from beginning to end in this context at all. This is the standard type of Arminian stuff. This book I'm holding here is recommended by Paul Owen, is containing great exegesis. There's almost no exegesis in it to be had. So continues, had they received Moses fully, thereby coming to know the Father to the degree possible at the time, they would have already belonged to the Father's flock, and the Father would have drawn them to the Son. And the biblical foundation of this is the scriptural words proving this are, and nothing's given. It's just, again, we can't derive our Arminianism from this text. So we're going to go back to John 5, make some overarching statements, come to a concluding statement, and then take the concluding statement and use that as the explanation of all of John 6, and basically hope no one notices in the process. So you have this Father's flock, and that it's the Father's flock. And who is in the Father's flock? Well, whoever chooses to be. We want to have free will here. It's all about free will. So they're in the Father's flock, and the Father would have drawn them to the Son. But in rejecting Jesus, they demonstrated that they had never surrendered to God in the first place, that they had set their faces like flint against all his continued overtures. Since they did not belong to the Father's own flock, they would not be part of the transfer of sheep already trusting the Father into the fold of the Son, John 6, 37, 39. There's the key. There's the eisegetical flipping of the text on its head. Is, well, what we're going to do is we're going to find a way to make all of these sheep that have chosen their shepherd by getting to know Moses. Okay, they followed Moses, so these are the good people. These are the good folks who have put themselves by their own free will actions and the goodness of their hearts. They follow the Father, so they're in the Father's flock, and so now it's the Father's flock. He gives them to the Son. And so people say, well, see, well, how could the Father give anybody to the Son? How were they his to begin with? And the amazing thing is the Arminian says, because they chose to be. In other words, it's man's autonomous choice that enables God to then dispose of men, to give them to the Son, and that the Son then becomes their perfect Savior. Fully man-centered, completely disconnected from the text. You would never get that by actually reading the text and just actually following it and getting your conclusions from the text. But that's the very nature of Arminianism, is you take overarching concepts, all wedded to a particular view of libertarian free will, and then you do to the text whatever you need to do to the text to make it fit into your overarching concepts. And that's what Walls and Dongle do, and then that's what people on the Internet are now doing. They're pulling this out, and they're saying, see, this is how you get around it. And they'll jump. And the way to detect this is in reading their stuff. You will see that they don't start at a certain point in John 6 and work through the text and follow the logic and follow the argument and allow the text to define its own terms and talk about grammar and syntax. No, they won't even get close to that. What they will do is they will make a statement, then they will jump around the text and follow their citations. Almost always they'll go to 40, 45, read it back into 37. They'll be reversing the actual order because they're not actually concerned about what the text says. They're concerned about defending their position. And so they'll jump down to 45. See, these people learned from the Father. And therefore, since they learned from the Father, they put themselves in the Father's flock. And that's why the Father gives them to them. Completely missing the fact that John 6:45 is a restatement of 644. And that learning there is not, well, they chose to learn. The Father was just teaching everybody. He taught everybody equally, and these are the ones who chose to learn. That is such a gross misreading of John 645 that it's sad to me to actually see people who claim to have some kind of exegetical capacity making that kind of statement, but it's the kind of statement they make all the time. 645 is actually a repetition of the same concept in 644, and the teaching there is divine in nature. It is in fact, the very mechanism, it's the way that Jesus expresses a restatement of that drawing, is that the Father teaches. He reveals. He is the source of this. This is a divine action. It's not something where God is just sort of throwing this out and we choose whether we're going to accept it or reject it or something along those lines. He quotes from the prophets, says, it is written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught of God. Who is the they? The they is those who've been given by the Father to the Son. We turn that around and say they are the ones who choose to be in the Father's flock. It's just amazing. Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Well, who is that? Those who were drawn by the Father to the Son, the preceding verse. Only by just tearing the text up, ignoring the fact that all of us would be offended if our words were treated this way. If we were the ones where people were taking, if someone took something I wrote and they went to the end of the paragraph and then they read that back into a preceding portion of the paragraph so as to make it self-contradictory, to turn my intention on its head, I would be upset with them. But that's what people do to John chapter 6. None of these people could ever sit down and start back at the beginning of John chapter 6, verse 1. Let's start here. Let's walk through the text. Let's define these things. Let's not jumping ahead. Here we go. And as soon as you try to force somebody to do that, what they go is, well, I don't think that any one text of Scripture has everything that God wants. We need to look at all these other things. And they'll immediately run off to John 12 or run off to, you know, whatever their favorite proof text might be. But they can't walk through the text. They can't deal with it itself.
Mm-hmm. This particular guy that I'm working with, he seems to attach a lot of significance to the Father drawing in John 6, whereas the Son is doing the drawing in John 12. How would you handle that? How would you address that?
Well, I think you need to recognize there's two completely different contexts between John 6 and John 12. And if someone is going to say, well, we need to look at these as if they are together with the word means exact same thing, same context. Prove it. Just ask them, okay, can you demonstrate? And see, the sad thing is so many of these people, they've never been taught to do meaningful exegesis. They've never been taught, they've never been put in a position where they actually have to defend what they're stating in any meaningful fashion. And so they play with the Bible like it's Play-Doh, like it's just something you can form and you can take a snippet here and a snippet there. If you're going to say that the drawing of John 6, which is by the Father, its object is drawing individuals to the Son who will be raised up on the last day, is the exact same meaning of the Greek term found in John 12, which in that context is the Greeks coming to Jesus. Jesus does not show himself to the Greeks. He hides himself from them. His hour had not yet come. This is Jews, Gentiles. And this is very, very clear. Right before the personal ministry to the disciples starting in John 13, John 12, he does not reveal himself to the Greeks. His hour has not yet come. That time is coming, but his hour has not yet come. He doesn't reveal himself to the Greeks. And instead, when he says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto myself, the lifting up is in the crucifixion. And the crucifixion then, the all men, Jews and Gentiles, this has to do with the means by which salvation is going to take place. But to try to say, well, he's talking about the exact same thing. No. I mean, does the cross naturally draw every single individual? I mean, how are you even using the word draw here? How can you say that it's the same thing, especially in light of the fact that in John chapter 6, the result of this drawing is the raising up that was seen in verse 45, the raising up that was seen previously in the preceding section before the Jews start grumbling and so on and so forth. If you're going to allow the text to define these terms rather than just ignoring those things, then you're going to have to see that this drawing by the Father to the Son is effective. The statement in John 12 is, Jesus is going to save Jews and Gentiles. It's not the same context. So to say, well, all words must mean the exact same thing, is to make language something that's nothing more than silly putty, and there's no one who could seriously take that as having any meaning to it.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Weiss.
You're most welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, I had I knew which websites he was referring to there because the Calvinist Gadfly had told me about that, so I had them up. It's a website, examiningcalvinism.com, and it's a section on John 6 and John 6:37, John 6:44. Excellent examples of utter eisegesis, how to turn the text on its head. And I'm sure the gentleman probably thinks that these, you know, what he's offering here is good, solid biblical argumentation. But am I stating something that is really, 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 really obvious when I say the internet is filled with a tremendous amount of really lousy theology? At least, you know, back a number of decades, you sort of had to convince somebody that you had something meaningful to say. You had some skills. You had some ability to handle the text before your books would be published, unless you wanted to had the money to publish them yourselves. Now it takes nothing. All you need is a computer and a modem. Remember modems? I remember my first modem was 1200, but I did get a 300 later on. I had a 300 later on, but that old Radio Shack laptop, you could actually see the characters coming across the screen. It was like, woo, look at that thing fly. But anyways, anybody with a computer modem can now basically demonstrate that they really don't know what they're talking about all across the whole world. And it's sad, but, I feel the weight of this tremendously for myself. Every idle word and will be judged. And I think that's not only what is said, and I say a lot, I talk a lot, have to, that's part of my work. But also I think that's going to include what you type and what you post and what you put out there. And people seem to think, well, this isn't going to be judged the same way as what I speak. No, I think it all goes together, and we might want to give some serious consideration to that. Again, program reminder, if you're just now tuning in, no one tunes. I mean, do you tune a web browser? You don't tune a web browser. It's like when we talk about taping something. We're not using tape.
They're net tuning.
Net tuning. But see, that's
net tuning.
That's an equivocation of the term tune. To tune. Remember those old radios we used to have that weren't digital and you had to sort of turn a little bit? In fact, when you're in a car, if you turn north, you had to like retune your AM station because you start losing it. Come on, you're older than I am. Don't give me that blank stare. You lived in Prescott. Did you just not have radio up there or just what?
It's net tuning.
Yeah, net tuning. Yeah, fine, whatever. Anyhow, we're changing the meaning of words, you know.
Well, what's the meaning of the word stretch?
I don't know. What is the meaning of the word stretch? Is that what I'm doing?
We're stretching for the closer here. Is that what we're doing?
Oh, is that what we're doing? I didn't know that. And here I am, a professional broadcaster, and you're explaining all of my secrets here. What is that? My goodness, people are going to think that we were actually just trying to fill that last 30 seconds there. That's terrible. Anyway, what I was seriously trying to say was we're not going to be here on Thursday. Looking forward to meeting all the folks in Tom's River. And we will be back again next Tuesday here on The Dividing Line. We'll see you then. God bless. Crossroads.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.